It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrer. It's coming up that today the Supreme Court ruled in favor of craft giant Hobby Lobby, who successfully challenged the mandate to cover birth control in the Affordable Care Act. We'll talk to a law and bioethics expert about this decision and what it means.
First, it's fair to say that here in Wisconsin, agriculture is a pillar of the state's economy. They don't call us America's Dairyland for nothing. But for farmers and agricultural workers, there's more to worry about than crop prices and bad weather. There's safety to be concerned about, too.
Our next guest says that agricultural jobs are the most dangerous in the world, but the issue rarely gets discussed outside of farming circles. And despite numerous safety improvements over the years, there are still too many deaths taking place on farms across the country.
Here to talk with us about the hazards facing farmers and what's being done to try to keep them safe is Jesse Hirsch, senior staff writer at Modern Farmer, who recently wrote a piece called Death on the Farm. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Jesse, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
So start out by giving us a picture. Just how dangerous is agriculture as compared to other industries?
Well, for the last 10 years straight in the United States and off and on for years before that, it has been the most dangerous industry. It beats out mining. It beats out construction. It beats out a lot of things that we would, if you ask the man on the street, they might say, what's a more dangerous industry? And around the world, over half of workplace deaths consistently are agricultural.
And in terms of these workplace deaths, what happens to people? What is the cause of death on the farm?
Well, when I first started looking into this story, it was just such a long laundry list, and I kind of struggled to find some sort of tie-in to everything, because it could be everything from when I was talking to farmers in California, they were talking about how there was a lot of migrant laborers who were not perhaps trained in English, and they had not learned the way to operate a tractor in a safe way, and there's a lot of personal injury lawsuits as far as that goes. Also, in rural farms in Montana, there is a difficulty with GPS and actually locating when someone does get hurt on the farm, so they may not get brought to the hospital quickly enough. So at first it didn't seem like there was any kind of logical tie-in with everything. It just seemed like there were a lot of various dangers. But then as I looked a little deeper, a big factor is that One, OSHA does not actually regulate any farms that have less than 10 people. And so typically if there's an accident in a factory or something else, something like that, there are fines, there are citations given out. There is an enforcement mechanism. But most farms, the vast majority of farms in the United States are farms that have less than 10 people. So in a lot of ways, these farmers are operating on their own.
In terms of the regulations that might help keep farmers safe and the education, how do farmers themselves feel about that? Do they want more regulations in place?
Almost down the line, just about every farmer that I spoke with, as much as they recognize that it is a frighteningly scary job that they do every day, and actually talking to their spouses, maybe even more so, these fears would emerge. As soon as you start talking about regulation, it was no, absolutely not.
Why is that?
Well, I think farms occupy kind of a unique position as far as occupations go. These farms that we're talking about that have less than 10 people, a lot of them, those 10 people who are on the farm, are the family of the farmer. If there's an employee, maybe it's one or two that are helping during harvest or planting. I mean, this is not across the board. Some farms are not like this, but a lot of U.S. farms are operating that way. And so if it is just kind of a family operation without a bunch of employees, the mentality is a little bit, this is mine. I'm going to do what I think is best for me and my family.
And OSHA, it sounds like, tried once in a while to get involved, but usually they get sort of shut down by the farmers themselves who may not want these regulations. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that OSHA can do?
Well, if the farm has more than 10 people, they enforce it just like it's any other industry. They did try to get involved this year. There are a lot of grain bin accidents. That's made the news quite a bit in the last couple of years, which is essentially people go into these grain bins or grain silos to take care of some sort of operational maneuver, fix something up, and end up falling in the grain and drowning, basically. And so OSHA specifically started fining farmers. They came up with a loophole that said that grain bins technically weren't part of a farm, and they started enforcing it. And there was such a huge backlash that they backed off.
Well, in terms of the danger on the farm, it sounds like it used to be that the biggest danger would be getting gored by an animal or trampled. And these days, the most dangerous thing on the farm is also one of the biggest time savers on the farm. It's the tractor. Tell us about what role the tractor plays on the farm.
What role doesn't the tractor play? It's so integral in every part of a farm's work. By and large, it is the most dangerous thing that the most dangerous farm implement. It's tractor rollovers, which can be an imbalanced load driving up a steep hill. It can be weather related. Sometimes it's when you see a tractor on a public roadway. It's a collision with a passenger vehicle. But there are safety mechanisms. On most tractors that are built now, you're not going to see one that isn't built with a rollover bar. But, however, there are still a lot of tractors out there that were built before rollover bars were implemented.
And what does the rollover bar do?
The rollover bar, essentially, if the tractor flips, if you picture kind of a dune buggy mechanism, it's over the top so that the tractor will not land on top of the farmer and crush them. And they actually work kind of in conjunction with seatbelts, which are also something that in researching this story are not very commonly used by farmers.
Are a lot of the tractors that are out there older? I mean, is it possible to retrofit tractors with these rollover bars?
Yeah, it's possible, but that is a choice. That's going to be an individual farmer choice, and that's not necessarily something that's going to be done. In fact, you sometimes see the reverse, where a tractor with a rollover bar, the rollover bar will be removed because it makes it more difficult to maneuver, especially when you're trying to get it into a barn or inside storage area.
Well, another thing we got to talk about is the number of young people who work on farms. Like you said, it's often the family of the farmer. It could be the farmer's children who are exposed to the danger. What kind of risks are young people being exposed to?
I mean, the same risks that the adults are exposed to, but a young person may not have the work experience or the life experience to make, you know, a split-second decision that an adult might after they've been farming for a long time. That's been a really big issue for a long time. In some states, it's actually legal for you to work on a farm if you're only 12 years old. But it got some mainstream media attention in the last 5 years, and that is one segment that has been decreasing steadily. Children getting in serious accidents or dying on the farm has gone down quite a bit in the last 10 years.
Well, we're talking right now with modern farmer writer Jesse Hirsch about why farming jobs are the most dangerous on earth and why it's so hard to change that. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
If you're a farm worker, do you make safety a priority, or does the thought get crowded out by other concerns? Do you have a personal experience dealing with a dangerous agricultural situation? What do you think could be done to make farming safer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Jesse Hirsch, senior staff writer at Modern Farmer, about the occupational hazards that go hand in hand with farming and what's being done to try and make the occupation safer.
You can join the conversation with your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. If you work or worked on a farm, did you see safety as a priority? What were some of the big risks? What do you think would help make farming safer? Call 800-642-1234 or post on our Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our callers now and take Kelly first from Appleton. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I actually work for OSHA. I'm a compliance assistant specialist, so I'm the person in the office that does the outreach. We have a special emphasis program in the state of Wisconsin. Right now, we're a pilot for it. We had it last year, too. And the emphasis program is towards the dairy farms. We can only go to those dairy farms, like your guest said, that are over 10 employees outside of the family member. Mm-hmm. But in Wisconsin, we have so many that are so far over that. In Wisconsin, our small family farms have been bought out by each other. and then they've taken on employees on their own. So we don't have very many that are under the 10. We work with the University of Wisconsin Extension. We've worked with the Cattlemen's Association. We go out, we do training on the animal handling, safe work when they're in the parlors. Let's see what else. The grain emphasis we've been out on constantly for the last 3 years.
Gotcha, Kelly. That's interesting. I'm surprised that there aren't more farms that are 10 and under here in Wisconsin. I think about Wisconsin as a place of the family farm.
It used to be. When you look at the dynamics nowadays, that we've really lost, well, the way our economy has gone, they've actually lost that and have been selling out their land.
So you're saying you are doing a lot of work with some of these bigger farms and they are being helped.
Absolutely. Yes. Right. And we're working with the smaller farms. We've had them come to UW Extension. They'll host. We have farmers that'll host. We come out and we'll talk to them about the safeguards that are in place, things that they can retrofit, best practices. In Wisconsin, that's huge for us. We had a really upswing on fatalities on the dairy farms, and that's why this became so prevalent for us. Once this kicks in Wisconsin, when they show what we're doing, because obviously it takes 3 years for any of the data to come through that they can actually read, I think you're going to see this emphasis program on dairy go to Nebraska, go to Illinois, and you're going to see that start growing.
Great. Well, thank you for filling us in on Wisconsin status, Kelly. Appreciate that. And Jesse, what do you think about some of what OSHA is doing here in Wisconsin to work with these bigger farms and the programs it's implementing here?
I think that's fantastic. I mean, certainly every little bit helps, and I think the outreach programs are great too, stuff that OSHA does, as well as local ag extension offices, and there's an organization called AgriSafe that also gives safety workshops. I definitely think that, especially in absence of an enforcement mechanism, a way to say you can or cannot do this, definitely education is key.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Kelly, and we're going to go next to Frank, joining us from Mason. Hi, Frank.
How are we doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. See, I guess I grew up on a little crop beef farm. I've worked for dairy farmers since I was 10. Safety is always a very large emphasis in every place I've worked. But the biggest thing that I see in my experiences is not so much driving tractors on the farm. It's taking a tractor from the farm to a field, and you have motorists that have no concept of a slow-moving vehicle sign that need to go 80 miles an hour to get absolutely nowhere and will pull off extremely foolish maneuvers. I almost had the front end of my tractor clipped off by somebody trying to pass a guy on the left-hand side in the dirt lane of the road.
Yeah, so what do you think about, Frank, driver education for people?
Well, I'll tell you, honestly, I'm 33. When I was 12 years old was the first year Wisconsin implemented a driver's education for tractors. I'd been driving a tractor, to be honest, since I was 6, and for my neighbors, cutting hay at 8 years old. But even at that point, my father, who was an implement dealer, was also a farmer at a very young age, ingrained safety because, you know, I mean, there's several instances where he, you know, could have got it. There's very few or, you know, few instances where I could have got it. It's just you always got to be on your toes.
Right. All right. Well, thanks a lot for the comments, Frank. Frank has been at this for a long time, since he was 8 years old. But in the beginning of his comment, talking about some of the dangers on the road, and it sounds like education is needed. What do you think about that sort of traffic and tractor interaction, Jesse?
Well, I mean, that's a very difficult thing to sort of, I mean, what you're combating is people's impatience. And, you know, I know that as a non-farmer myself, when you're driving on the road and you're behind a tractor for an awful long time, you can feel like, oh, I need to get where I need to go. But, I mean, there just needs to be more awareness that this is really risky. You know, that there are so many accidents that happen when you try to pass at a place that's not safe, when you're going too fast to try and get around a tractor. I mean, even there's been a lot, and if you Google in the news in the last 5 years, a lot of Amish farmers that drive buggies have gone off the road by impatient drivers. It's a bad thing.
Well, thank you for that call, and we're going to go next to John. John joins us from Houston, Minnesota. Hi, John.
Hi.
What do you think?
Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Well, I agree. Well, people don't pay attention to traffic, period. Everybody's in too big of a hurry. And I work with horses and Amish guys, and I was born and raised on a farm, and I'm a logger. The whole thing is that you got to pay attention and don't get in a hurry.
All right, so pay attention, don't be in a hurry. And, you know, I have to say the tractors that I've passed on the highway have been very courteous. It seems as though a lot of the tractor drivers are well-versed in the tractor safety. Maybe the driving end of it needs to be improved on.
I think that's definitely true.
And Jesse, we've been talking about all the hazards, and we haven't even covered all of them. I mean, they're a dangerous job, a lot of deaths in farming. In terms of what keeps people going back in the face of such hazards, what do you think keeps people going, and how can we keep them going and keep them going safer?
As far as getting people to continue farming,
right,
just in general? Well, I don't think that there seems to be too much worry about people not loving farming. I mean, to a person, every farmer that I talk to would not give it up. No matter how many, I went to a particularly dangerous county in Iowa that had seen a lot of accidents and deaths in the last 5 years, and not a one would be deterred by that. You know, stories of people, their fingers getting knocked out of their socket while they're birthing a calf, and then just continuing to go through. It's the type of job that people are pretty passionate about, and I don't think the dangers are going to waylay too many farmers.
You talk a little bit about mental health and the toll that can happen along with farming. Suicide is a risk with farmers. Mm-hmm. Is there a mental health angle to this that needs to be approached?
I think there is, especially in India. They've been doing some exploration because it is the number one demographic that is suicidal, and all, but here in the United States as well. Even the week before I visited Iowa, a pig farmer had killed himself. A lot of times there seems to be a tie-in just with the economics. It's a very risky profession as far as your fates are kind of based on the weather and a lot of things that can't be controlled. And there have been a lot of farmers that have taken a real beating in the last 5 years, in the last 25 years for that matter. And you are seeing a lot of correlation with suicide with that. So definitely some mental health outreach would be highly recommended.
Are there programs out there right now that help farmers deal with the emotional side of it?
I didn't come across any that that were specifically mental health farmer targeted, but that does not mean that that doesn't exist.
You write in your piece that this is a problem that we're not really talking about. So what are some of the other big ideas that we need to talk about to make farming safer?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to get on my soapbox, but one idea would be a little bit more oversight. But that's not really going to be a very popular idea, so I'm not getting up and saying that from a megaphone. But you know, I spoke with politicians who had considered it. You know, who see that this is a very dangerous. I talked to some state senators in Washington State and in Iowa, and they weren't going to touch the issue. It's a hot potato, and they know what happens. So it becomes a little bit tricky. That it is not seen under the same sort of oversight that being a construction worker would.
Got a comment here from Gary on Facebook who says, one of the significant reasons that there is not good safety performance in the agriculture industry is that it's generally run by sole proprietors and not large companies. Large companies understand the cost of accidents and the benefits of reducing or eliminating them. What do you say to that?
I definitely think that the solitude of the work comes into play. I mean, you look at a factory, and for one thing, you just have more people looking at, seeing what you're doing at any given moment. There's more checks and balances. You have a supervisor who can say, no, you know, like that's not the way we do things here. That's risky. When you've got so many of these farms, and they're typically very small operations, you're going to be out there alone a lot of the times on your tractor. And so it's just, you know, in the blink of an eye, you can make that mistake, and without someone there to kind of step in or, you know, let you know maybe that's not what you should be doing, it's a little trickier.
Jesse, are farmers good at helping other farmers, passing along wisdom about ways to stay safe, especially if they're not being regulated, say, by OSHA, if they're 10 and smaller? Are they good at helping each other?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think the farmer network is wonderful. Farmers help each other not just in ways to stay safe, but ways to make their farms more productive. I mean, I definitely think that is one of the primary sources of information, is just word of mouth and conversation. And being that I was in this small, concentrated area and talking to farmers who all kind of knew each other, that's the sense that I got. Like, oh, you know, especially when you see an accident that's happened to one of your neighbor farmers, that is something, you know, you're probably not going to make that same mistake the next time.
Jesse, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Jesse Hirsch, a senior writer, staff writer at Modern Farmer. We've got a link to his piece, Death on the Farm, on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out what happens when virtual unreality becomes part of the real world.
First, we're talking about the Supreme Court's ruling in the Hobby Lobby case announced this morning. Hobby Lobby successfully challenged the mandate to cover birth control as part of the Affordable Care Act on religious grounds. They said some kinds of contraception, like Plan B, are tantamount to abortion.
Here to explain the greater implications of this ruling is Alta Shero. She's professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. Alta, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics here. What exactly was Hobby Lobby and one other company challenging in court?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, what most people call Obamacare, requires that employers that have more than 50 employees, that is larger employers, provide the full range of preventive health measures without making people pay for them. It's good public health policy. But that includes contraception, and that was a recommendation from our National Academy of Sciences. So Hobby Lobby is a very large company with over 570 stores, but it's what we call a closely held corporation. It's just a small number of people who own the majority of the stock, and the two primary owners are very religious. They said they did not want to have to comply with this requirement because it would have to provide health care insurance that would include coverage for forms of contraception that they object to. One thing that's worth noting is that they actually did cover exactly these kinds of contraceptives for years. Dropped the coverage in 2012 and then filed this suit. So there is some question about exactly how much it's an objection to the policy and how much it's actually a religious objection. But that did not play a role in the court's decision.
And the majority said, yes, in fact, this would infringe on the religious liberty of Hobby Lobby and other corporations in a similar status. This doesn't apply to all companies or corporations everywhere, though, does it? How narrow is this ruling?
It does not. How narrow it is a little unclear. So it does not apply to public corporations, the ones that have stocks traded in the stock market. But about half of the corporations in the United States are what we call closely held, and they would all be the kind that are now the subject of this decision, where we're now talking about the corporation, not the owners, but the corporation itself having a religious viewpoint that can be burdened by a generally applicable law like providing comprehensive health care insurance.
And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the dissent. What concerns did she raise there?
Well, she had several concerns. The first one was her concern at talking about corporations having a religious viewpoint. It's certainly novel in American law. We've never thought of corporations that way. It seems to be an expansion of a very controversial decision earlier about corporations having free speech rights that played into the financing for campaign. The second concern was that the court, which was interpreting a statute from the 1990s, which prohibited a substantial burden being placed on religion unless there was a compelling purpose that had to be managed by the government. She said, where's the substantial burden here? I mean, these people are not being told they have to use birth control. They're not being told they have to support birth control. Their employees may or may not use the birth control. All they're doing is providing the health care insurance, and they have an option, which is they can just say, well, we don't provide health care insurance at all. They pay $2,000 per employee to the government, and now the employees go out onto the public Obamacare exchange, which is subsidized by the public. So she said there's no real burden here. This is a very tenuous argument for complicity with an act they view as immoral, and that really has a lot of implications for many other ways in which people could now argue that they feel complicit in what they view as immoral acts by even paying a salary or by taking a photograph or opening up a venue to people to marry that they don't approve of. So this notion of burden and complicity is actually very important.
Well, even if it doesn't spread that widely, one concern is that if there are religious concerns to covering, say, a medicine developed with stem cell research or animal research, if somebody's religious views preclude that, Could that be a likelihood in the next couple of years?
Well, I think it's entirely possible. I don't know how likely it is. Certainly, a lot of what's going on now is driven entirely by opposition to the Affordable Care Act or by abortion politics. So we have to figure out how likely it is to extend to other areas. But you mentioned one, embryonic stem cell research, that is also tied to the abortion debate. And second, almost as controversial, has been same-sex marriage. And these are areas where I actually can easily imagine a closely held corporation bringing a suit saying that they don't want to have to abide by some general federal law, that because they view it as making them somehow complicit in an action they view as somehow immoral. There are even certain vaccines that were originally developed with fetal tissue that could be incorporated into this as well. So we could see healthcare insurance that does not cover vaccinations for your children for chickenpox and German measles.
Briefly, some people have challenged the notion of birth control as an important part of preventive care. Briefly, can you talk about that?
Sure. Birth control is actually a very ordinary part of life. 99% of women use some kind of form of birth control in their lifetime. And we now have seen that they are not all the same. They come in varying degrees of effectiveness. And here's the challenge. The ones that are the most effective are also the most expensive, things like the intrauterine device, because once it's in, it works. You don't have to take a pill every day. There's no problem with forgetting or your partner not putting on a condom. So these things are extremely effective. And about 1 out of 3 women who use contraception say they prefer to use something like an IUD, but they can't afford it. It can cost as much as a month's salary for a low-income woman. So if we really want to reduce the number of unintended pregnancies, about half of which, by the way, result in abortions, we could try to make it easier for women to afford the best forms of contraception. Then they don't get pregnant when they don't want to, and then we reduce the number of abortions, which is one of the things everybody can agree is a good idea.
We'll leave it there for now. Alta, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That's Alta Shero. She's professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. The internet has revolutionized how we gather and consume information. It's also made a huge amount of info available to anyone interested in finding it.
Well, the digital revolution has leveled the information playing field. It also means that anyone with a device and a Wi-Fi connection can publish and manipulate data.
So, how can we figure out what is truth and what's fiction in this new online world?
With us now is Charles Seif, professor of journalism at New York University and the author of Virtual Unreality. Just because the internet told you so, how do you know it's true? Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you start your book with a story about how a Sesame Street character went from being the star of one guy's whimsical pet website to kind of an actual player in Middle East imaging and politics. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, that was a very curious story. There was this website for a number of years early on the web called Bert is Evil. And it was one of these joke websites where some people photoshopped Bert, the Muppet character, into various historical situations, like an evil Forrest Gump or an evil Zelig. So they photoshopped a picture of Bert sitting behind Hitler or consulting with Pol Pot or riding along with Stalin. And they also created one with Bert standing behind the shoulder of Osama bin Laden. And it was just this joke, and it circulated around the web. People laughed. But then September 11th happened, and there was a series of protests in the Middle East and Indonesia supporting Osama bin Laden. And there were a number of print shops that put out posters of Osama bin Laden with his picture on it. And on one of these posters, there behind Osama bin Laden's shoulder was Bert. And there it was in Indonesia. People were marching along, shouting down with the USA, holding up placards with the lovable Muppet Bert in support of Osama bin Laden. So what happened with this idea, this joke idea that Bert is evil, crystallized and became real. He actually became evil in some sense, hanging out with Osama bin Laden in real anti-American rallies. Of course, the Muppet Masters, the Children's Television Workshop, were furious. They thought it was immoral for people to use Bert's image to support Osama bin Laden, but I think that was the least immoral thing going on that that day. But it was a good example of how this idea of kind of in a fringe, a joke that wouldn't have gotten very far before the days of the web, got all the way to Bangladesh and Indonesia and wound up being projected on the world stage. And people actually took photographs of those burnt behind Osama bin Laden posters.
And Osama bin Laden's code name during the final operation that took his life was apparently Bert.
Yes, the association stayed until the very end. The SEAL team called him Bert.
It's an example of what you call virtual unreality. How would you define that term?
Virtual unreality is this... It's a state of being where things are no longer entirely real or entirely unreal, that we are filtering our reality through a new set of tools, through digital tools. Digital tools that help us view the world, digital tools that help us gather information, digital tools that help us disseminate information. And those digital tools sometimes work beautifully and help us and amplify our thoughts and project them, but sometimes they distort things in strange and subtle ways. And sometimes other people use them to distort our ideas. And we're becoming unaware of the fact that we are being digitally manipulated. And so virtual unreality is a state of being where we are dependent upon a new set of tools that have worked their way into our lives, and we're unaware that these tools are manipulating and controlling the information that we view.
Yeah, and you say at one point that it used to take an entire force of a totalitarian government to create an alternate reality, and now it can be done to smaller effect by a guy in his basement or sitting alone, you know, somewhere in Scotland, as we saw as another example in the book. How do we go from being an easy audience to this kind of unreality to being a skeptical one?
It's not so easy because it's a lot of work, and because there's so much information out there. One of the great things about digital information is that there's a huge amount out there, and everyone can put it on the web and publish. You go to Twitter, you go to Facebook, everyone's publishing, and so there's a huge amount of information out there. There's so much that we actually are dependent upon robots and filters to bring to us what we want to view. And so that creates a vulnerability. For example, with Wikipedia, all of us, if you're looking up something for the first time, you go to Wikipedia. It's fairly natural. It's a pretty good resource. But there are people putting false information in Wikipedia all the time, sometimes for jokes, sometimes to manipulate public opinion. My favorite example is of a baseball player, an outfielder named Mike Trout. And someone jokingly put in his Wikipedia entry that he had a nickname, the Millville Meteor, named after Millville, New Jersey, where he grew up. It wasn't true, but it became, because it was in Wikipedia, it was cited in a baseball encyclopedia and then wound up in the Daily News. And once it was in the Daily News, Wikipedia pointed to that Daily News article as proof that, yes, in fact, this guy is named the Millville Meteor. And all of a sudden, Mike Trout was baffled to notice that people were calling him the Millville Meteor. He had no idea where it came from. But now he's actually nicknamed the Millville Meteor. He's signing baseballs, the Millville Meteor, because someone created this idea in Wikipedia. And it turned from this falsehood into reality just by the force of being put in Wikipedia.
And advocates of the sort of crowdsourcing that Wikipedia does might say that this is good, that it's sort of a democratizing way to disseminate knowledge. What do you think about that argument?
Well, democracy is good, but the thing about knowledge is it's not democratic, that there are minority opinions that are, or even fringe opinions that are correct, and the majority is wrong, that you can't take a vote in this operating chamber to determine whether or not the heart has three or four chambers. It just is. It has four chambers. And the thing about Wikipedia, it's very powerful at gathering a huge amount of eclectic knowledge, and it's a very good resource. But because everyone is collaborating and voting on these ideas, it's not necessarily the best source. It's not accurate. It has the wisdom of crowds, but it also has the stupidity of crowds as well. So a reference written by a real expert is going to be better. But what's fascinating about Wikipedia is sometimes you have these experts joining in and trying to change Wikipedia entries to make them better, and they get overruled, and their edits get changed by the crowd.
You have an appendix in your book. It's called The Top 10 Dicta of the Internet Skeptic, and number one is, Wikipedia is like an old and eccentric uncle. Is that the way we should think about what we find there?
Yeah, yeah. It's fun to sit with your uncle. He can tell you a lot of stuff, and he knows a lot. He's been around. But sometimes he's been drinking a little too much. Sometimes his viewpoints are a little off. So if there's anything that's important to you, I mean, Wikipedia is a very good first stop to find something out, but if it's really important to you to know whether it's correct or not, Wikipedia is not the end of your journey. You should use Wikipedia to start out your searches and then go to more reliable, more authoritative sources.
Another piece of ground that you cover is social media, and you also write in the same appendix that social media's site's purpose is to serve its users in the same sense as a zoo's purpose is to serve its animals. So given the number of people who are involved every day in social media, what do we need to know to be skeptical and be savvy about how we use it?
Yeah, social media, I mean, if you think about it, it's a boon to all of us that we're able to keep in touch with our friends, we're able to tap into current trends. But the way that these social media companies make their money has nothing really directly to do with making you, the user, happy. It's making their advertisers happy, or their sponsors, the people who are paying money. And sponsors are made happy when you, the user, are exposed to new products and buy new stuff. And so it shouldn't be any surprise that social media companies aren't providing you with a platform out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing it to sell you products, and they're also doing it to extract information from you. And every few months, there's some sort of uproar as one of the major social media platforms, Twitter or Facebook is particularly bad at this, changes their privacy policy to do something that people find outrageous. And there's a complaint on the Internet for a few days, and then it disappears, and people continue using Facebook as they did before. But that means that Facebook is gathering a huge amount of information on how you do business, what websites you look at, how long you spend on these websites, whom you communicate with, why do you communicate with them. Now Facebook is going to be gathering information on sounds and what you're listening to. All this information is monetizable. It is valuable and is being gathered with your implicit consent, even if you're not aware of it. And this sort of information is not something you'd be giving the government or people outside of your close social circle. If the government were demanded to listen in on everything your cell phone was saying, you would rightly feel that this is the action of a totalitarian state. But when Facebook listens into all of your conversations online and possibly even to all the sounds in your room, that's progress. Everyone seems to be happy with it.
So given all of this, Wikipedia, social media, the ever-ready audience of the Internet, what specific tips or tools can you share to help us separate reality from unreality?
Well, there's a few things. The first thing is anything that's important to you, always try to find the provenance of the information. Trace back a bit of information to where it comes from. It's not that hard to do it often. Start with Wikipedia and go through the references, see where they're getting their information from, and trace it backwards. Similarly, when someone tells you something, it's important to understand whether that is coming from a neutral point of view or a biased point of view. You have to figure out who that person is. And often online, it's not easy to figure out whether somebody's a real person or not. So in the book, I give you some tools like using image searches or using what are called IP addresses to try to trace back a person to his origin to see whether he's real or not or whether he is faking something. Generally speaking, it's just the book is attempting to make you aware of these manipulations that are going on. There's no fast and easy answer because these tools are very useful to us, that we're saving a huge amount of time by having robots do our news gathering for us. So we're not going to give it up. But we do have to be aware that this is a different way of life than it was just 10 years ago, in a very concrete and scary way in some time, in some ways. So awareness is part of the battle, that when something comes through the news wires and it's breaking across all over Google News, just having that little sense of skepticism in your mind that there's a lot of manipulation out there, and taking a step back to see whether it's real rather than rushing on the bandwagon would benefit.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was Charles Seif, the author of the book Virtual Unreality.